to order. Today is Monday, April 16th. We are, and pardon my being late, but we are approximately 8 minutes behind time. And my pleasure today, members, is that since we are going to be moving a little faster, the time is moving on, that please make sure that all of the questions that you have on this hearing that we're doing today, that you get it out and you can feel comfortable about the direction in which we're going or not going. And that at least your questions are answered as the department presents today. So maybe what we need to do is, in way of trying to find our way through this, is as the presenter gets started, what we will do is give him a chance to get through that one program area and then ask questions. If that's going to be okay with you, I'd love for them to go on. Or if you feel that your question needs to be answered at the time, feel free to do it if it's pressing that much on you. Because we really do need to, since we are having, this is about reauthorization, and we want to make sure that we get it out. Mr. Britton will give us an overview of this week's activities, along with some historical data. Dr. Bates?
Yeah, I just want to make a statement before we get started today.
Sure.
I could be right now in a very interesting hour and a half meeting with global warming.
Yes.
Given that to be here with you.
Thank you.
And I just want to make a statement that this is going to make up for my arrears with you for the incident Friday night.
Oh, no, uh-uh.
Okay.
We got to talk about that.
No, I think it should be enough to
settle
the score here.
No, excuse me just a minute. Senator Gordley, Senator Gordley.
I still.
Yes, ma'am. Excuse me, Senator Bates. She asked for special privilege.
Senator Bates, I think it would take you, the rest of the legislative session to make amends for your omission.
Would you please tell the committee what that omission was?
Oh, we don't want to go into that today, do we?
Please tell us what this is all about.
We arranged for a nice dinner for the Ways and Means Committee on the Road Friday night, and after the end of the dinner, we were supposed to go over to where we're going to have the hearing, and I had a large car, I took a bunch of people, and we all kind of went upstairs and loaded the car up, and I noticed we had a couple of empty seats in the car, but I...
You didn't.
And so, three very nice ladies had made a quick stop on the way up before the elevator, and I was about 4 blocks away, and I got a phone call, and the good Senator Carter let me know in no uncertain terms, as only she can do, that I should turn around, come back, and pick everybody, which I did, immediately.
Good news.
It was really embarrassing. And of course, the car was full of three guys.
Yes.
None of us had ever, it was terrible.
Absolutely terrible. Thank you, Matt. Now, so he thinks that I'm going to play the light
with
him. Oh, no.
I'll keep
on. Punish him more, Margaret.
All right.
You guys are supposed to stick together with these issues.
Well, on something like this, we had a very wonderful time.
I love it.
Senator, thank you so very much for that. Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Senator Carter. I'd like to turn to the week's agenda for the week of April 16th through April 20th, which is in front of you. You'll know today and tomorrow that we're having a public hearing on Senate Bill 5547, which will be used for the Department of Human Services 2005-07 Budget Rebalance Plan. Tomorrow we're planning on working this bill, Senate Bill 5547. Senate Bill 5547 is also in front of you, and you'll notice that it is a blank bill that we will amend completely to facilitate or implement the department's rebalance plan as the subcommittee approves it. On Wednesday, we have a public hearing scheduled for Senate Bill 5525, which is the budget bill for the long-term care ombudsman. And that public hearing will include time for public testimony on that particular budget. Thursday, we have two bills scheduled: public hearing and work session for Senate Bill 5525 the long-term care ombudsman's budget, and a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1034 relating to nursing assistant certificate fees. So that's what's on at present, what's on the agenda for this particular week. Today,
on the agenda, any question on the agenda? Thank you.
Today, we're going to be having a public hearing, as I said, on Senate Bill 5547, which is the Department of Human Services budget rebalance. The department has come before the emergency board, and actually we had a special session last April devoted to the rebalance pretty much. There were a couple other bills in that special session, but the primary reason we had that special session was to appropriate money both to the Department of Human Services and to the emergency board to take care of an imbalanced rebalance plan. And we'll show you about that in just a moment, kind of give you some history with respect to the rebalances that the department has put forth so far in the current biennium. So this is not a bill for 2007-09. It's a bill for 2005-07. With that, Madam Chair, with your permission, I will go ahead and hand this particular hand out. What I just handed out to you members is a line item of where we have been over the course of the last of the current biennium, and for some of us it's kind of nightmarish actually. You can see on line one the legislatively adopted budget. This was the budget that the legislature passed for the Department of Human Services 2 years ago, a total of $2.5 billion general fund. This does not show obviously other funds and federal funds, lottery funds, and so on. It's just a portrayal of what has happened to the general fund over the course of the biennium. Line 2 shows that in January 2006, the department presented a rebalance report to the emergency board that said that they needed an additional $168 million of general fund in order to carry on their programs as they had been instructed to do so in their original budget. The primary sources of that additional money had to do with caseload, match rate, a federal match rate that was less than what was assumed in the adopted budget, along with a variety of other things, but the main drivers had to do with caseload, match rate, and I think some cost allocation issues as well, and some revenue issues. In April, early April, the department presented an update, and at that time, the rebalance report was that we no longer needed $168 million of general fund. That had been reduced to about $136.2 million. Some of the caseloads had been forecast to go down a little bit. The forecasts had gone down, and there were some other management savings that had been identified as well. Lines 4 and 5 and 6 show the special sessions action. They really did two things at the April 2006 special session with respect to the DHS rebalance. The legislature made a direct appropriation to the department of $52.9 million general fund, and that was to take care of both the federal match rate change and also to take care of some closeout issues that related to cost allocation that had arisen from the prior biennium. The thinking there was that some of the other things might change between April and December, but that there were a few things, $52.9 million worth of things, that were pretty well set that a direct allocation could take care of. The remaining 83.3 was made as a special purpose appropriation to the emergency board to deal with things like caseload, where the forecasted caseload might change between April and December. And you can see that by December, on line 7 here, the December 2006 emergency board made an allocation from that 83.3 of 73.4. So at that time, indeed, some of the caseload forecasts had changed. There were other issues that came to light, but the emergency board made an allocation of 73.4 rather than the entire 83.3. Line 8 shows that the amount remaining in the special purpose appropriation is today $9.9 million. What Dr. Goldberg and his staff will show you in just a moment is that they are bringing forward a rebalance plan that shows a new need of about $9.1 million. But their request is for the remaining amount in the special purpose appropriation. Now, one thing that you should note, it is somewhat of a technicality, but that special purpose appropriation would have to be disappropriated. This isn't the emergency board. This is the full legislature we're dealing with. So the special purpose appropriation would be disappropriated, and then another appropriation of whatever the legislature intends to use for this rebalance plan would be made to the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, the department has given me two sets of materials to distribute, and when they're ready to begin, I will do so.
Okay, thank you. Representative Morgan. Thank you. Just, Mr. Britton, for clarification, the 9.9 that's remaining, is it still in a special purpose appropriation? It's still sequestered?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, yes, it is still in a special purpose appropriation to the emergency board.
May I have a follow-up? Is the 9.9 used at all in the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I'm not sure of the answer to that. In other words, I'm not sure whether the governor or the co-chairs have assumed that money would otherwise revert. I don't know the answer to that. We can find out.
If I could request to get that information, Madam Chair. Any questions?
All right, Madam Chair, I will hand out two sets of things that the department has prepared.
Dr. Goldberg.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. John's handing out a couple of documents, one which looks like this, which I'm going to start off with. What we had hoped to do today was a couple of things. Number one, I wanted to spend a few minutes filling in a little bit of the detail around what John just talked about, what's happened in the department between November of 2005 and today in terms of issues around our finances, our fiscal accountability, et cetera. And then what we had planned to do was to walk you through our rebalance line by line, talking about all of the issues that are included in there, if that's okay with you.
That's okay. Please take a moment. Senator Wesley is upstairs observing this meeting. He has a call, and I said, we do not want your call. So he has been excused from the committee, except he's observing upstairs. Thank you.
Okay. If you turn to the second page, you'll see the exact numbers that Mr. Britton had put forward. About 15 months ago in the fall of 2005, the department 6 months into the biennium, discovered that we were $168 million overspent in the budget as we projected it out into the future. This was due to a couple of issues. One was a need for greater fiscal accountability within the department, and another was the understanding of the need for greater forecasting accuracy and to better understand and plan for caseload volatility. When I took over the department at that time, it was my pledge to the legislature and the governor that these would be the issues that we would work on over the ensuing year. And what I'd like to do is walk you through what we've done over the current past year. Let's start with page 5, which is fiscal accountability. In November of 2005, when I assumed the head of the Department of Human Services, I asked the state controller to, at that point, assemble a team of statewide experts to do a complete review of the department's finances. The state controller assembled a group from Department of Treasury, from PERS, and from several other departments, and they did a complete review of the DHS fiscal operation, reviewed our accounting, our banking, our cash receipting, our budgeting, our internal controls, our cash flow, a complete review of the department. The group also visited three states known for their fiscal management, and they submitted a final report in May of 2006. That report wasn't really the type of report that sits on a shelf. It was an operational report. It was a report that laid out step-by-step both short-term, medium-term, and long-term, the types of things that the department should be doing to become more fiscally accountable. If you turn to the next page, we developed from that a work plan with a series of timelines, responsibilities, and deliverables to bring the agency into a place where we had the fiscal accountability that people in the state deserve. On page 7, you can see at a high level a schematic of what we put together. One, we established an oversight committee, which was comprised of some legislators, Representative Morgan and Senator Carter, as well as other legislators, LFO staff, BAM staff, provided some high-level oversight. There was a steering committee made up of executives from other state agencies, as well Treasury, DAS, as well as individuals from BAM and LFO. We had put together a series of work plans based on the tone and expectations of staff in the department, a committee that looked at our working capital and our cash flow, the ability to put together accurate budget to actual reporting, the need to develop a financial code of conduct for the staff, the need to train our financial staff so that we had the kind of quality staff that could do the work. We had a work group looking at our accounts receivable and our recovery with a series of work plans, invoicing, payment, and receipting. And you can see the manner in which we approached this task. Each of those had timelines, deliverables, which we continue to work with. These groups are submitting business plans, looking at how we can simplify and get better accuracy and value for what we're doing in the agency. During this time period, we reported regularly to the emergency board at every meeting on our progress, actually brought out the work plans and the checklist step by step about what we've done. We reported regularly to the oversight committee, and we have a steering committee which continues to meet monthly to continue to monitor our progress. On page 9, there's just the membership of the oversight committee. On page 10, get into some of at a high level the accomplishments that we've undergone. You know, the first thing is that we've totally restructured our entire financial organization. Hired a second deputy to function as a chief financial officer. The previous structure of the organization was one in which there was a director and a deputy director who were, in essence, interchangeable. And that was a management structure that I don't think really fit the size and the scope of an agency like ours, where we needed to have a deputy director responsible for the day-to-day operations and a deputy director that could function as a chief financial officer and had the skills in which to do that. We restructured the organization, took our budget and accounting chops and moved them under the direct supervision and responsibility of the chief financial officer. Previously, those functions had actually been dispersed within the agency. Jim Scherzinger was hired as our chief financial officer. We moved budget and accounting under him so that he could provide the kind of oversight and supervision that we needed. On page 11, we have established a financial code of conduct for our financial staff, and what that means is that our staff now have a greater understanding of what their responsibilities are, what their conduct should be, and they've been trained and are moving forward with that. We didn't have accurate budget to actual expenditure information in the hands of our program managers, which meant managing a budget was very difficult. We have now put in place some prototypes, and we'll talk a little bit more of that in a moment, about how we can put into place real-time budget to actual expenditure information so that we can manage our programs effectively. We've made a great effort in training our staff. We had a number of recommendations about what was needed to have quality staff trained. We've implemented those recommendations. We've had, in the past, some concerns about our ability to manage our cash flow and to establish the appropriate working capital for the agency. We have a committee that's made some recommendations, and we've actually constructed now a cash flow model where we now can model our cash flow needs on a daily basis. We have, as you'll see, discovered that we've had some issues around our ability to track and manage our expenditures in some of our institutions, particularly in the Oregon State Hospital. We've changed our management structure there. We now have a dedicated financial officer, in essence a chief financial officer for the hospital, and an analyst so that they can manage the finances of the state hospital. We've made a great effort at changing the culture and establishing a new way of doing business. And that has been really to focus on what our work is and really embrace what have been a variety of business techniques, which I could generally summarize as being lean management, which are an approach to doing business that has been, I think, embraced by many businesses in this country, which is in essence a relentless pursuit of removing waste and bringing greater value to what we do. And what we have done has been to begin in our financial arena looking at every single process that we do, from the point in which we start putting together a budget throughout our expending those dollars, to be able to understand each and every process, how they work. We've mapped out hundreds, actually embarrassingly thousands of business processes. And if you come up to our fourth floor, you'll see yards and yards of butcher block paper with each and every financial step that we go through painstakingly laid out and mapped. And as we've done that, we've examined each and every one of those processes to look at, do they bring value? Do they provide accuracy? Do they take away from accuracy? Looking at how we can improve the way that we do this. We haven't done this alone. We've actually engaged the help of a national consultant, the Kaufman Global Company, that's done this for major Fortune 500 companies around the world, where they can come in and help senior management and help management begin to understand the each and every business process and plan appropriately. It's actually been a pretty remarkable process. We've involved and all of our employees from the bottom up, because the issue is that it's the people that do the work who understand it the best. And our employees have been intimately involved in this and actually quite enthused, because they themselves want to have the right tools to do the job. We have wonderful staff who work with us, and their problem is that we've created systems and processes that inhibit their ability to do a good job. And so what we've been able to do is look at all of those processes with the help of the folks from Kaufman Global, map each and every one of those out with the goal of being able to get timely and accurate financial information to our managers. And what we've been doing is very consistent, I believe, with the directions the legislature is looking for us and other state agencies to go in, which is that we're establishing a series of metrics that begin with every single employee and map up throughout the organization so that everybody understands what their work is, understands how it's measured, and has an accountability for those types of metrics. That's a lean management system where we're working towards a place where every day our employees can come to work and meet with their supervisors for several minutes in the morning, understand what the work is, what the metrics are, what the responsibilities are, to be able to provide the kind of accuracy and continuous improvement that we need as an agency to optimize the work that we do. It's really been a great process, and where we've been focusing this on, we've been doing this as a pilot program, focusing it at two places. One, using this as a way to create accurate and timely budget to actual information, and two, focusing on our cash receipting process. With the goal being, and you'll hear more about this later on in the Ways and Means process when our administrative services comes through, but we'd like to actually do this throughout the organization, not just in our financial management, but these are techniques that we believe we can and should apply throughout the agency to be able to run better. We also needed to establish greater accuracy and understanding of our forecasting processes. As John indicated to you, our $136 million fiscal problem was due to a couple of issues. It was one, due to some of our inability to appropriately account for our finances. It was also due to our inability to understand and appropriately plan for caseloads. And when I say our, it was actually a collective our ability, because I think all of us have a part in that. 85% of our budget is spent buying services out in the community. We either buy health care from doctors or managed care organizations. We buy nursing home days for individuals that are in nursing homes. We pay for direct benefits to some of our clients. We buy food stamps. And we pay foster parents. That's 85% of our budget. So what our budget is driven by the caseloads. if we have more individuals in nursing homes, then that will increase our expenditures there. So where I'm going with this is that to really understand and to accurately plan for the Department of Human Services budget means we have to really understand our caseloads. And you as a Ways and Means Committee need to really understand our caseloads. And our caseloads are volatile. They are subject to a variety of environmental factors, which I think you're all aware of. When the economy goes down and more people are unemployed, they look to the state for increased support. When we have problems with substance abuse, such as our methamphetamine epidemic, that drives our child welfare caseload. 60% of kids who are in foster care are there because their parents have substance abuse problems. So when we have an epidemic of meth use in our communities, that affects our caseloads. When health care costs go up and businesses can't afford to provide health care for their employees, some of their employees look to the state for support in getting a health care benefit. When there are policy changes at the state or the national level, that affects our caseload, and we see those all the time. Right now, you've been dealing with the TANF program. Well, I can tell you, what concerns me about the TANF program is that we have huge changes at the federal level to a program, and we're looking to now understand what our TANF caseloads will be in 2009, when we have yet to even know we've no history with that program. And then the last piece is that right now we're making decisions about our caseloads in 2009 based on what our caseloads and program histories were in 2006. So this is a huge task to be knowledgeable, to do the best we can in our caseloads. Let me tell you about some of the things that we've done, because I think we've come a long way over the last year in improving our caseloads. One, we've improved our forecasting methods. We use more timely data. We used to use data that was 6 and 8 months old. We now try and use much more timely and up-to-date data. We've improved some of our technical tools. We've implemented some new methods to enhance our forecasting. The biggest thing we've done has been to improve our reporting. And what we have done now is, rather than looking at caseloads every 6 months, we look at caseloads every single month. And what we do is we compare our caseloads each month to the forecast and try and understand if our caseloads are not tracking with our forecasts, why that is. Have there been policy changes, environmental changes, programmatic changes that we've made? What can we do? Some of those things we can manage towards, others of them we can. But we have now...
Dr. Goldberg?
Yes.
Dr. Goldberg, how long have you been doing the month-to-month comparison?
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, approximately 7-8 months now. Okay. We've been doing that.
Thank you.
I can find out exactly. We had a group comprised of four legislators, Representative Richardson, Barker, Senators Mona Sanderson, and I believe Senator Nelson, who we met with leadership staff first every month, and then we started to switch to every quarter to review those. Mr. Britton was there. We as a staff do it every month. And I think that we have, by doing that, learned a tremendous amount and are better able to understand the directions our forecasts go in.
Thank you.
We've increased our oversight and review of our forecasting process. We have a team from DAS, some of the forecasting experts from the folks in the economic office and the other forecasting offices within DAS, working with us to review our forecasts. Our Lindsay Ball, the DAS director, and myself sign off on every single forecast that we do. Our field staff and program managers now participate in reviewing those forecasts. We've put together a group of community providers to provide us input. Oftentimes it's doctors and nurses and others in the field who see things coming before we do, who are able to, emergency room doctors who see patterns of usage in the emergency room, or nursing home staff who see things before, see trends and see the sort of canaries in the coal mine, so to speak, before we do. We've put together a group of community providers who meet with us regularly to look at our forecasts and give us a sense of what either they see coming or whether these sort of line up with what they're seeing. And we have a number of forecasting experts from academic institutions in the private sector who work with us to provide some of the same things. What we've been able to now do is better understand some of the risks of our forecasts, and our forecasts now include confidence intervals. You know, one of the amazing things that we've done in the past is that in 2004, we thought that we could tell to the person exactly how many people were going to be on the Oregon Health Plan in 2006. And in fact, you have budgets that are based on, from our 2006 caseload, we put through forecasts which provide to the person a sense of what the caseloads are going to be in 2009. Personally, I don't think that that's a very reliable way of forecasting, and what we've moved towards, if you turn to section page 18, although it's not numbered, what you see on page 18 is, this is the Oregon Health Plan caseload forecast from January 2000, actually it's not a forecast, from January 2000 through the current time period, are those dark filled circles, and that's our caseloads on the Oregon Health Plan. You can see it's pretty volatile due to policy changes. When we cut 100,000 people off of the health plan, our caseloads dropped rather precipitously, and you can see exactly where that happened. There was no way of being able to predict that a year ahead of time, what those caseloads would be. You can see when you get out into the current time period, we have a series of circles which are not filled. Those are what we are anticipating as the caseload out into 2009 and out into 2011. But bounding that line are confidence intervals based on our forecasting group's ability to look at the past and some of the risks. And quite frankly, that's probably a better place to look at how we think about our caseloads, as not being a single line, but being a risk area whereby we certainly need to pick a line to budget towards. But we need to understand that there's likely to be a contingency on one side or another that we may see lower than anticipated or greater than anticipated caseloads, and be able to understand what those are, what the risks are. As Senator Bates and I were joking before, I mean, who can anticipate what the price of a barrel of oil will be in 2009? Or what the state's unemployment rate will be in 2009? Or whether or not we will have cured the meth epidemic, or whether there'll be an epidemic of something we know nothing about today? All of those things will drive our caseload forecast, and we need to be better aware of that. In the long term, and this is the last page, and then I'll be quiet, we can go through the dollars and cents of our rebalance, is we need to be even smarter than what I've laid out. We need to be able to do a couple of things. One is, Senator Winters and I have talked about, we need to be able to regionally forecast, because we understand that parts of our state look very different from others, and that the economies, the needs are really different in parts of our state than in others. Not just to be able to forecast, but to be able to manage and plan for need as a management tool. So that's one piece we need to look for. We need to be able to incorporate some of the demographic and social factors into our forecasts. Let me give you an example. Right now, we forecast caseloads in the Oregon Health Plan based on some of the historical data and information that we have. But what we really need to work towards is something that looks different, that says, here are the number of people in the state without health insurance, or the number of individuals living below poverty who rely on the state for health care. That's our universe. And then we need to, from a policy perspective, pick what we want to do to meet that need. Do we want to have programs that meet 80%, 90%, 100% of that need? And then look to us as a department to actually carry that out. And that's a different way of looking at some of the forecasting than we do right now. So those are some of the things that we'd like to look to do in the future. It's actually what some of the folks who have been reviewing our forecasting have encouraged us to start to look at, and I'm hoping that in the future we can do that. It's also a piece we'll talk more about later in the budget process, because we have some policy packages to do some of this work. It's, I think, as you can see, vitally important that since our entire agency is driven by our caseloads, that we really understand what these are, and we're trying to do that in the best way we can. So I wanted to give you a flavor for, in essence, what we've been working on the last year. And I think we've made great progress on our fiscal accountability. We've made great progress on our forecasting. We've got a lot of work to do ahead of us. I'm not by any means thinking that the work is done, but we've made a good start. We continue to work hard. We've got a good team. And we continue to remain committed to being transparent, to being fiscally accountable, and to providing our program managers with the information they need to manage programs, with the legislature, with you, with the information that you need to make the appropriate policy, and to be as transparent and as accurate as we humanly can. That also means over the last year we've uncovered more than our share of problems. We've uncovered all sorts of warts, blemishes, things that we need to do better. The state hospital, as you'll hear about, is a place where we've understood we need to have better fiscal accountability, and we will do that, and we will continue to do that. So let me stop there, see if there's any questions about this piece, and then we can move line by line through the rebalance.
Dr. Bates?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. I'd actually like to have some comments from you about how this might affect forecasting. I'm not going to get into the thing you sort of touch on of what this
population looks like and how it affects the rest of the healthcare system will be here forever. But let me ask a couple quick questions. One, several years ago we moved from one-year eligibility, which is the norm in the commercial market for healthcare, and went to a six-month. That I would think makes things a little more volatile. People coming in and out faster, it's more confusion, it's more cost. The commercial market has gone and stayed with 1 year because it's more predictable, more understandable, and cost less. So I'd like to have a comment from you on that. Secondly, we are likely to go to annual sessions in this building. One of the reasons I think for doing that is it gives us a better understanding of our budget, especially ones like this that can vary so much. So if you comment to that, I'd appreciate it. And the third and last thing is we've been using the outside actuarial service, which is expensive and sometimes difficult to get good information from and when you need it quickly. You've been talking about going into an in-house actuarial service. I'd like to know where you are on that and how it would help you with the forecast. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, 6 to 12 month eligibility would bring more stability to some of our caseloads. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, it also gets at, I think, what I was referring to, which is take our kids who are in our Medicaid program. There are a number of children who are eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled. And there are several reasons for that. One of them is they keep falling off every 6 months when they need to re-enroll. And if we looked at setting a target, saying our target for the state is that every child under 185% of poverty, which is our current eligibility, should be on the health plan. And Bruce and the rest of DHS, we want to hold you accountable for that. We'd come back and say, well, here's what we need to do. One of them is 6 to 12 month eligibility. Others are to look at some of the ways we can do outreach. But it's a different way of forecasting, and yes, indeed, 6 to 12 month eligibility would provide greater stability. In terms of annual, I'm not going to comment about annual sessions because that's a political issue which is out of my purview, but I will comment on annual budgeting. And I think the issue around our budget is the fact that, as I indicated, right now you are putting together a budget for us that is based on the policy and the caseloads in 2006, and you're putting together a budget out into 2009, halfway into 2009. So when we get out there, that budget is going to be based on policy and history, which is over 3 years old. By doing that annually, we can, I think, get better accuracy. And the last piece is on the actuarial piece. We will be discussing that as one of our policy option packages in the future during our administrative services session. We have a policy option package to bring actuarial services in-house. We believe that we can do two things. One, we can provide the information we need cheaper and more accurately by bringing it in-house, doing the work ourselves rather than contracting out. And number two, we can then use that data and information to better enhance our ability to forecast and plan.
Dr. Wilbur, I want to give you kudos for following through because on this committee last time was Representative Morgan and Senator Gordley and Senator Winters and myself, who was barely here because of my work on Ways and Means. But I'm sure that they can take some pride in the fact that the directions that they gave you, you've accomplished some of these goals. And so I want to give you kudos on that. And we have never officially welcomed Mr. Surgeon back, someone that who is much beloved in this building, and so we thank you for your wisdom in having somebody with experience about this process rather than going on out of town, bringing somebody else in who would cost probably more money and would not have the wisdom of history and stuff on on this body, so thank you so much for that. Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner.
Just a comment to Dr. Goldberg. I'm reflecting on your words about annual budgeting. And the Public Commission on the Legislature, on which I serve, had quite a bit of discussion about the feasibility of annual budgets as we were having a discussion about annual legislative sessions. And what I'm recognizing now is what we failed to do as a commission was consult with you, Mr. Scherzinger, those of you who are administering the largest agency in state government. We didn't get your perspective. That's, I'm just reflecting on that. It's not too late, though, to get some of your thinking into the legislative committee that's chaired by Senator Monroe, and that is looking at legislative reform. So just hold that thought. Mm-hmm. We can talk later.
We'd be happy to provide that input. There's a lot of ways to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, I think, whether it's annual or biennial, I think the bigger issue is to understand the volatility,
mm-hmm,
and to be able to plan appropriately. And that's more the issue. I mean, if you could do that inappropriately in a one-year budget as much as in a two- or three-year budget. But the bigger issue and the biggest issue to me is to not think that we can set a budget and then walk away and, it'll be the same 2 years down the road. We need to plan for the contingencies. We need to be able to understand them, and we need to collectively. What was the greatest thing we did over the last year was, I think, two things. One was our oversight committee with Chair Carter and Representative Morgan and others, understanding the issues and some of the complexities of an agency our size. And the forecasting group was really phenomenal in terms of legislators understanding that when we make policy, they have effects on our caseloads, and the interaction between that sometimes I think we fail to appropriately appreciate, and sometimes there's unintended consequences, and that we need to be able to understand those. So it's been great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is exactly what I was hoping to hear, and I remember it probably was about a year ago when we talked on the phone because I had to pull over to the side of the road because I was going to lose you. You've done everything you've said you were going to do and then some, and it's making sense, and the public commission piece makes sense to hear your actual empirical data back it up. And I guess my final statement would be my mantra of, I hope we can hire Oregon first.
All right.
Indeed.
Your pleasure. We have 30 minutes left, and we need to go through this rebalance. So if there's further questions, and I certainly want to, your hand is up, we want to just go quickly because we need to do this today.
And I know we need to go through quickly, but I also know that one of the values that you brought is to educate members of this body. And I think that the more we know how the department operates, and not only operates, but those factors that impact the agency, then we have a better concept of how to address the budgetary needs, not only caseload drivers, but also the fact that your agency probably has more factors coming from the federal government than I think any other agency in this building or in the state. So I think the more that we understand those dynamics, the more we can help you get your work done. So I just want to say thank you for helping members to understand those dynamics that exist inside of the department.
Thank you. We're all in this together.
Thank you.
Go for it.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, I'm Jim Schulzinger, Deputy for Finance for the Department of Human Services. I'm just going to say one quick thing and then pass it over to John, and he's going to start through the detail, and we're going to kind of go back and forth just to give a little comic relief. and the one thing I'm going to say is to again sort of come back to something Mr. Britton said, that this is about our rebalance for the current biennium. So we're not trying to predict where we're going to end up at the end of 2009. We're just trying to figure out where we're going to end up at the end of June. And although, having said that, it's a $2.5 billion general fund. To try to land that, actually multiple appropriations on a dime is a pretty difficult thing. I think last time the department was here in the same position 2 years ago, we were about $50 million off, so, as it turned out. And so there's always a chance, especially with caseloads, that these predictions won't come true. I do believe that the staff has done a lot of work, and we'll talk about some of that as we go through this, that we have more confidence that these numbers will come in than we've had before. But nonetheless, it is a chancy thing, and I just want to point that out. So I'll turn it over to John and let him start through the analysis.
Okay. I guess I'll be speaking quickly. Chair Carter and committee members, my name is John Swanson. I'm the administrator with the Finance and Policy Analysis Unit within the department. And we're here today to present the DHS Rebalance Plan for April 2007 and have provided a department overview rather than a division overview to be able to summarize these issues. As you will see, that and has been discussed, the department has identified a need of about $9.1 million general fund in this rebalance plan, which is less, as we've noted, than the amount remaining in the special appropriation. That 9.1 relates to about a 0.3% increase over the current legislatively approved budget general fund. Hopefully you would have in front of you now the display that lists six major issues identified within this rebalance plan, and the subsequent pages of this report break those issues into some detail. Quickly to walk through those, you can see that the first item is the aggregate of all the caseload changes within the department, the Division of Medical Assistance Plan, CAF, Seniors, People with Disabilities, and Public Health. Total to a $36.3 million savings in general fund projected for the remainder of the biennium. Second item relates to a need for additional general fund to achieve maintenance of effort requirements within the Children, Adults, and Families Temporary Assistance for Needy Families federal grant and avoid grant reduction penalties at the end of the federal fiscal year. There are a number of other and federal fund revenue adjustments we've identified as a result of the work that Dr. Goldberg has mentioned that we've implemented in sorting through our financial information more closely and the improvements that we made there. Some of those will result in changes in general fund, either savings or need. It nets out to a $7.7 million general fund need. We've identified some expenditure issues within the mental health programs, the institutions, a need of about $9.2 million there. We've also identified that the conversion, the transition cost to the state data center will actually require some additional general fund at the Department of Human Services, about $3.9 million there. And then there's the suspension of the reduction of Oregon Health Plan benefits. These were previously delayed, and now they would be not made at all, which not having those reduction options would increase the need for general fund by about $2 million. And then we have a remaining all others, which, again, are detailed further in the report, that net to about a $1.7 million savings for the department. Overall, again, it's a 9.1% or $9.1 million of the remaining special appropriation that we're requesting for the specific issues identified in this plan. And we're also requesting the remainder of the special appropriation be appropriated to the department as a contingency for unanticipated changes as we close out the biennium. So with that, I'd like to start through the subsequent pages. If we'll turn to pages 2 and 3, we have the details around our caseload changes. The first item on the front page, just quickly to walk you through. Down the left side of the display are the different kinds of client types that are served in the different divisions. The middle columns are the biennial average monthly caseloads. The first column being our latest spring forecast that we just completed. The second column was the fall forecast that our December rebalance was based upon. And then you can see the changes between those two forecasts. And the next columns display you the actual average cost per case. This is not a rate, but it's the average cost of all the types of services provided for those client types, and or the change in that rate depending upon which of the divisions that we've presented here. And then on the right side of the display are the resulting dollar changes in the caseload cost for the department. And I was going to just kind of walk down through some of the larger ones, point out that you can see on the right-hand side there, within the Division of Medical Assistance Plans, those clients who are eligible for medical services because of qualifying for TANF, Temporary Assistance Needy Families, actually have declined, as we've talked about earlier in the number of cases there, which results in about $11.2 million general fund savings. Seniors and people's disabilities is slight changes, but you'll note that the cost per case for those caseloads is fairly high, so even minor changes in the caseload or cost per case can drive a significant savings there of about $5 million. The poverty level medical women is a slight increase in cost per case, not because of caseload, but because of a slight increase in an increase in the cost per case. Part of that is due to clearing of a backlog of some of the claims for maternity care that we were able to do to bring those current, which increased the overall cost. As you can see, the total Division of Medical Assistance Plan caseload is a decline of about $17.8 million, caseload and caseload-related costs. The next section is the children, adults, and families, and the larger change there, as you will see on the far right side, is a $7.25 million savings, again, in the TANF program, which is related to the DMAP part as well. I do want to point out, though, as you look at that, and you look at the savings in the self-sufficiency programs in caseload changes, that we are displaying these here as caseload savings to be transparent and to bring those forth. However, because of the maintenance of effort requirement, we don't really or aren't really allowed to take those or can't really use those savings and still achieve the maintenance of effort. So they are savings here, but you'll see them again in just a few minutes coming back at us, which Jim will talk about on the maintenance of effort issue. Within the seniors and people with disabilities, we had some fluctuations in the caseloads, but overall,
there's questions.
Excuse me, sir. That's it.
Can we ask questions when we have time?
We can. Please do. Please, members ask questions.
In employee-related daycare, this is part policy, part cost. This is a less than expected increase, obviously. How much do you think this is related to the fact that we pay incredibly low rates for employee-related daycare, the lowest in the nation? Am I reading that correctly?
As far as
employee-related daycare, caseloads are up slightly but less than expected, so you've got a 2% reduction.
Right.
And $2.9 million savings. But how much of that, when you did your forecasting, is the result of incredibly low supplements that we get? You're 50th in the nation in that.
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, I don't have that information with me. I'm wondering if
you can go.
What Senator Bates, I believe what you're asking is, we certainly, this is a program in which we provide a subsidy. And if the subsidy is so low that our families can't access and pay for child care, one would surmise, although I can't tell you that there's a direct cause and effect, that there are individuals who may not avail themselves of this program to the extent that they would if otherwise.
Just to ask another question. If we were paying higher rates in terms of our subsidy, do you think that you'd see these kind of savings, even though not as many students take advantage of them, do you think?
Chair Carter, if we were paying more, we would be experiencing certainly greater per case. I mean, it would cost us more in the budget, and we might be likely to see more people avail themselves of the program, although I don't know the direct correlation, and we could have some of our experts talk to you about that if you'd like.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be true, though, if we did pay more and we had more stability, not only in the provider workforce and the relative affordability of the co-pays, we probably wouldn't see the fluctuations in the caseload either in terms of forecasting?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, I would agree that there would likely be much more stability in a market to be able to do that. And, you know, the other issue is that, you know, this is also a program where what we want to do is we want more people to be at work and to be able to become self-sufficient. And so there's other effects on other caseloads if we can help do that within this program. That's really the goal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, on seniors and people with disabilities, you'll notice that the caseload changes are minor and fairly much net out to a slight savings. The larger savings in these costs, caseload costs, is in the home care worker program, where we've had some savings in the area of the home care worker health insurance and some FUTA savings there, as well as some savings in training costs. Those basically comprise the savings for the most part within the caseload cost within SPD, about $6.4 million. A total of 7.2 for the whole division there. The last item is within the public health division, and it's a reduction in the cost. Again, caseload has not declined significantly in the AIDS drug assist program. However, we have a savings in the actual cost of the program due to more clients enrolled in health insurance plans that provide the drugs that this program provides, and also some additional funds from the Ryan White grant, which has been able to be used in lieu of general fund for this program. The combined total of all of those that I've walked through very quickly is $36.3 million reduction in general fund need, which was the first item on the front page. That takes me to the second issue, which I'll turn over to Jim Schruzinger to talk about in regards to the maintenance of effort need.
This, the issue of maintenance of effort in the TANF grant is extremely confusing one. So I prepared a separate sheet that you may find useful. And I think you'll be able to see just from this sort of brief discussion just a little bit about why it's confusing. But I hope I'll make it a little bit better. This effort on maintenance of effort is, we have done a lot of work this last few months on figuring out the fund splits, how programs' costs split out between general fund and other funds and federal funds, particularly in the maintenance of effort area, and in how the institutional accounting is handled in mental health, and in the administrative services division. So, oddly enough, with all this work, most of these issues you see on the page turned out to be in those areas, because this is where we really felt like we needed to do a lot more work on the fund splits. And this is, as I said, one of the more confusing areas. If you look at the handout right at the top, it says that the TANF maintenance of effort requirement is in some ways pretty simple. It says that we have to spend $91.6 million per year of state funds on TANF programs. Now, the truth of it, there's a formula behind that, and that will be an issue if we get into the next biennium. But for right now, $91.6 million, we have to spend of state funds every federal fiscal year on TANF programs in order to meet the maintenance of effort requirement. And if we don't meet that requirement, then we lose the equivalent amount of federal funds, and we have to make up the difference. And so there are penalties involved in, or a cost involved in not meeting it, and so it's something that you want to do. As we started looking at the fund splits and forecasting out where we were going to be at the end of this biennium, we found a significant issue in our ability to meet MO in this biennium. And that's incorporated in this $24 million that's listed here. Now, I sort of put four areas that add up to that. The first one is one that John already talked about, and this one is, you know, sort of theoretically kind of simple. It's that we've had caseload reductions in TANF, which would, of course, normally save us money because the caseloads are down, and a portion of that is paid for by general fund, so we should save on the general fund. But because we have to make a minimum amount of spending, a fixed amount, we can't really take those savings there. We have to, in effect, take them on the federal fund side, and we have to continue to spend at the rate we were spending before. So he said we had a $10.5 million savings. Well, we're adding that back and saying, no, we can't really save that money. We need to spend that money in order to meet MO. And so that's the first... The 10.5 of that $24 million is simply that we can't take the caseload savings on the general fund side. We have to take it on the federal fund side. The second thing that happened is in the middle of this biennium, that spending on some of the other CAF programs other than self-sufficiency were declared ineligible for MO. So in the middle of the biennium, they swapped spending. They said, well, instead of spending our general fund on these ineligible programs, we'll spend it on TANF, and we'll shift federal spending the other way. And when they did that, we overestimated the amount that could be shifted by about $4 million. And so that accounts for about $4 million of that $24 million need. Thirdly, there's about $1.2 million in maintenance of effort. One of the things about maintenance of effort, it is not just spending within DHS that qualifies, but it can be spending in other parts of state government. And even tax credits to some extent. And so we have a process whereby we count this other spending as helping to meet MO. And about $1.2 million that was expected from the Commission on Children and Families was not achieved in the last federal fiscal year, so we've had to make that up. And then fourthly, about $8.3 million in the Administrative Services Division was not achieved because of the way that the Administrative Service Division was budgeted, and we'll talk about that when we get to some of the other costs we found in ESD. So those four items essentially add up to the $24 million in general fund need. And I do have to say that although this sort of restores us to where our original budget was in terms of having enough general fund to meet MO, that the department has in the past had a history of what you might call front-loading general fund spending into the biennium. There is a 3-month lag between when the biennium ends and the federal fiscal year ends, and so there was a practice at times in the past of, in order to solve a biennium budget problem, spending less general fund, and then when the new biennium starts, throwing a lot of spending into the general fund to meet the MO requirement, because you got 3 months in there to do that. And we've done that. We did it at the beginning of this biennium because of the problems in 0103. And so this solution here, all it does is it sort of keeps us even. And we're still going to have a significant MO problem coming into the next biennium. Now, a lot of things are happening in these programs beyond just this, but beyond just having to get over this hump on MO. We've got a lot of folks out looking for additional sources of MO. There is an analysis that has to be done, as is being done, on where we are in the upcoming budget on MO. It's a complex puzzle, but this at least holds us even with respect to this biennium. So I think if there's any questions on the MO part.
Do you have any future projections? Because we go through Mo every session. And even though we look like we're even now, and I appreciate your cautiousness if you don't want to answer, but at some point we've got to get where we are balanced. And is there any, and you said you've got to come in work to where we as legislators know what the real picture is.
I think we've made some progress on that analysis, but more needs to be done. And as I said, it's a complex issue. We think we have a task force that's looked at additional sources of Mo, and we've got some optimistic results from that. But on the other hand, the higher participation rate requirement next time in terms of getting employment participation, as well as the some of the other program changes that we're looking at, really require a more substantial analysis than we've done. And so now that we've sort of got a handle on where we are this biennium, I think we're making progress on next biennium, but more needs to be done.
Because as the federal position is shifting more and more for states to assume more and more, and Mo is a piece of that. And I think, you know, if as you get do your analysis and as it's finalized, you know, I certainly would hope you share those with us.
Absolutely.
Because we really need to know, as this shift is taking place, what the impact's going to be on the budget.
And I think you'll see a very significant analysis in the reshoot. That's essentially what where it has to happen.
I really agree with Senator Winter's discussion here that maintenance of effort has been kind of a cat and mouse game that we've been playing here ever since I've been working on these budgets. And when we were going through the 01-03 recession, we were certainly doing the same thing back then. And I think that it clearly is a game with the federal government where we're trying to identify more existing investments that we can use, and they're trying to push us into just flat increasing the investments, which is not always possible for us to do. So this is, I think, going to be an issue that always defines, because we get to a place where we think we found the, you know, great new pot of maintenance of effort money and slot it in, and then find out down the road that it didn't turn out to be such the great idea that we thought it was when the feds take a look at it. But I'm curious, because some of the maintenance of effort is local match that comes through our partnerships with the counties and the cities and things like the Commission on Children and Families and all of the nonprofits that they're wired into. Is that kind of where you're thinking about going with this, more into that nonprofit sector?
Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, yes, that is, we're looking at things that I don't believe we checked into before, looked into in not only within the department itself, but within all the other state agencies, in light of any changes in the Mo policy that may open up the availability for Mo or more addition, more Mo than we have in the past. And we're also looking beyond even that into counties and into faith-based potentially. So we've got a task force that we've put together that has made considerable progress. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to nail any down yet, but we've got a lot of good leads that are promising at this point to improve what we're able to count as maintenance of effort, which will probably mitigate some of this problem.
But that's going to leave us with some policy choices.
Right.
I mean, there's two issues. One is, you're right, it's a game of cat and mouse. One issue is that we've been playing that game blindfolded,
right.
Quite frankly, and that we haven't been able within the agency to understand some of our own internal fund shifts to be able to compete. Now we believe we're getting to a place where we've got the fiscal information to be able to do that. We hope to be able to identify some more eligible funding to count towards MOE. If we were to do that and, let's say, identify 10 or 15 or $20 million over the next 3 months, which would be great, we would be able to see some savings of general fund in terms of doing that. We would then be in a position of being able to use those, make a policy choice to be able to use those funds to pay it forward and get us back to a place where we should be, or do as we've done historically in the past, which is not do that, remain already starting out the biennium behind and use the dollars some other place. We hope to be able to provide you with that policy choice in the future.
Well, and if I might, Madam Chair, I think that you've discovered the last unexplored frontier here. And what I come back to is that the Feds seem interested in pushing us into a place where we invest more money. And so it would be interesting to see this from their side of the discussion. And the other thing that comes immediately to my mind is what's going to happen with the Secure Rural Schools funds from the county's perspective in the investments that they're able to make and sustain over the long term, too. And I hope that as you have those discussions in the work group, that the potential impacts of the step down in that funding get worked over, too.
Representative Cotet? Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you for this summary. This is probably the most succinct description of this I've ever seen. You know, the Deficit Reduction Act provides us some opportunities as they've redefined what we can use as maintenance of effort and some other things. I look at this as well as the TANF redesign as an opportunity to actually recommit and perhaps invest. I would hate to see us search for all these MOE opportunities and then take that general fund that we could be reinvesting on this very vulnerable population of children and their families to help get them on the path to self-sufficiency. So this is a really interesting puzzle. So I look forward to seeing the analysis connected with the TANF redesign as it relates to MOE particularly.
Thank you very much, and we look forward to carrying on this conversation tomorrow.
We'll be back.
All right.
We'd like to get